Welcome, everybody, to the Diecast Movie Podcast. For this episode, we have a special interview brought to you by my dad. Take it away, Dad.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast. And today's episode will be an interview. Other episodes that we do are movie discussions where we roll a die and that decides the genre of the movie we're going to pick. But today I'm doing an interview with Greg Mullavey, who I met last year at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention in 2022. I just want to make a note that we recorded this episode about a few months after the convention. So this was done prior to the strike, and I just want to let everybody know that. And also, hope to see everybody there at this year's Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention from September 7th through the 9th in 2023 at Hunt Valley, Maryland. And if you want more information about who's going to be there at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, go to MidAtlanticNostalgiaConvention.com, and you can see who's going to be there. And also you can listen to the episode where Martin Grahams, who runs the convention, and I talk about the convention this year and also on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Otherwise, I hope everybody enjoys the interview, and we're going to head into that right now. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast, and today we're doing an interview. I have Greg Mullavey, who a lot of you will know from Mary Hartman. But besides that show, he's done many other TV shows, lots of other movies, and theater work. And he's still working and doing a lot of stuff today. My children grew up watching him in iCarly when he played the grandfather. Welcome to the show, Mr. Mullavey.
Great to be here, Steve. So we were talking earlier before we even began the podcast about my background in the Army. That's one of the reasons why I did a MASH episode. My time in the Army helped me, inform me, gave me information about that. And so that's how I met Steve, doing an autograph signing thing in Maryland, Hunt Valley, Maryland. And happened to meet Steve there, asked me to do this podcast, and I'm here. One of the reasons we were selling pictures of me having done MASH with being a it was season 7, I think. And I played a captain in the Army that was Hot Lips' boyfriend, for those of you MASH fans out there. Anyway, I was not a captain in the Army. I was a PFC, private first class. I was inducted into the armed services by Uncle Sam during the Cold War years. That dates me pretty much, but nonetheless, I was there, and as I was telling Steve earlier, I managed to play baseball and do theater while I was in the Army. My dad, I was in a special outfit monitoring nuclear explosions, and my dad got me out of there by talking to the coach of the team. My dad was a baseball player, played for the White Sox and the Red Sox. I was also interested in other sports, but baseball was my main game. I was captain of my high school team and also captain of my college team. So I was a pretty good baseball player. So my dad got me out of that outfit to get into special services. And the coach of the team, Fort Monmouth, I was at in New Jersey. And I began to play baseball. And I got into a play at the same time. So I did a play and then played baseball in the armed services. And I played in Germany, too. So I had quite a history with that was my beginning of my time in theater. I was in the Army. The first play I ever did was a play called Snafu. I was at Fort Monmouth in New Jersey, no less. It got me interested in theater. I started going in on weekends to New York because it wasn't that far away, an hour. And I started watching theater, getting involved with theater. And that's how I got my start. My interest, my passion began then. I loved going to the theater on weekends. And sometimes during the week and come back late, late at night, be up in the morning for my whatever duties they had for me. It was just the beginning of a long, long career. That's how I got my start.
That is an amazing start. But before we continue from your start, you brought up your dad playing baseball.
Yeah.
And I'm interested because you two spell your last names differently.
Yeah, my dad spelled his name. That's a long story, too. Mullavey. Mullavey, he pronounced it. The old Irish spelling of my name is Mullavey, the way I spell it. I found that out from my grandmother because she brought me to see some two old maid aunts who were living in Detroit at the time, and my as was my grandmother. That's where my dad was born, Detroit, Michigan. And I went and I looked at the, I was about 18 or 19 at the time, and I looked at the name tag on their apartment, and they had their name up there. And it's M-U-L-L-A-V-E-Y. And I said, what? These are my relatives? Well, that's the way they used to spell their name when they first came over from Ireland. But my great-great-great uncle, Uncle Joe, changed the name to Malady because he thought Malady was too Irish sounding. He was prejudiced against the Irish at that time. A lot of us were immigrants at the time. Some of my people came over from in 1840 to South Carolina, and others came through Canada via the St. Lawrence Waterway and into Windsor, Michigan, and then, you know, came almost illegally across the river and got into Detroit with the automobile business. And the automobile was the first being formed in the early 1900s. And those companies like General Motors and Ford were being formed, and others, Hudson. And my family got into the automobile business. And one of my uncles, great-great uncles, became a head of Fisher Body, which is a big deal. He was the richest guy in the family. So he changed his name to Malisi, and he made it more sound more Jewish. Which may be why I play a lot of Jewish roles, especially in theater. Yeah.
That's interesting.
My very first television job was a Jewish character. Tom Stern was the name. I did that with Telly Savalas. It was 1961, no less. My first TV job.
Wasn't it something about with a verdict in where the audience?
It was called The Verdict Is Yours. That was the name of the show. The Verdict Is Yours, and the audience would then vote by phone, I guess, as I recall it. Yeah, as to whether I was guilty or not, and therefore could change the ending of the show. We shot alternate endings: guilty, not guilty. And so it was interesting. It was a fun show to do, that's for sure. Had the lead in it, no less. So my very first television role was the lead. Most people, you know, go in with a very small role, but I had a big role. So it was kind of cool.
And you got to work with Telly Savalas, who, if I remember reading correctly, they voted guilty.
Frankly, I don't remember what it was, what the verdict was. To tell you the truth, you know, I think I was not guilty. I pleaded not guilty, that's for sure. Anyway, it was great fun. Then I began the career in television that way. Of course, I'd done theater before, but that's how I started. And I was working at that time for CBS, and I was in the mailroom. And I got my first job running, you know, delivering mail to the various executives. And I thought, well, maybe I'll become a producer or something like that. But then I got this job, and that changed that story. I was also going to school then. I already had a degree. I majored in philosophy in college, no less. And I didn't do much theater there. I did some review work, singing and dancing. That was kind of fun for me. I liked to do that. My family liked to sing. I was a pretty good singer. I had done that in college, but I had not done a play. Mm-hmm. I wasn't interested in doing a play when I was in high school because I was playing sports. So... anyway, and I happened to be able to, I graduated high school when I was 16. I skipped a grade. I was one of those smart kids and got good grades, and I was bored by the, so they skipped me. Those days, people did skip grades if you're kind of advanced. I had a very active intellect, so read a lot of books when I was a kid. I had read Moby Dick when I was 10.
You read Moby Dick when you were 10?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I loved it, too. I loved that novel.
Yeah, I think I read Moby Dick when I was a teenager.
Being an actor, you have to be smart. Be pretty smart and intuitive, too, I think. Part of the gift you get. You know, I did a radio show when I was 10, and I was raised an Irish Catholic, and the priest told me at that time I did a radio show for them. He said, young man, you have a talent. You know, God gave you a talent. You should pursue that. Don't throw it away. And I never forgot that. Not that I ever thought I'd be an actor, but at that time I wanted to be a ball player. But I remembered that he had told me that when I was that age, 10, and that informed me as I went forward trying to get enough money to go to an acting school. I got out of the Army. And I wanted to go to the neighborhood playhouse in New York and study with Meisner, but I didn't have enough dough to do that, so I had to go to work too. So I worked and then went to L.A. because my parents were there. Because my dad had been coaching. He was the coach for the Brooklyn Dodgers, first base coach and infield coach. And when they moved in 1958 to L.A., of course, I went with them. So I went. That's how I wound up in L.A.
Yeah, because I see.
And then what happened? Yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna say with your dad's baseball career, because he played a little bit in the major leagues, but he had a long, long minor league career, and then of course, like you
he
said,
did.
Went into he was a player coach, and then went into coaching for the Dodgers. So you were all over the place, as I'm sure, as a child with a parent that's a ball player. You know, there's a lot of times you're in different cities.
Yeah, I was. I wound up. Well, I actually not that many. Because my dad had an 11-year career in Buffalo, New York, playing for the Buffalo Bisons. After he had hurt his arm playing for the White Sox and then the Red Sox, his wing was never that good after that. He was trying to play shortstop for a while, and he had to move to second base because it was shorter throw to first base. He would overthrow, underthrow, because his arm was hurt. He had hurt himself sliding. In those days, they didn't teach you the way they teach you now. I mean, now it's a whole science. In those days, older guys didn't help because you threatened them their job. Mm-hmm. So there was very little help, and coaching wasn't what it is today. They had like two coaches or three coaches, maybe tops. And today they have a whole, you know, like 10, 12 coaches on each team. So it's a very complicated, much more complex way to play baseball these days than it was then. And in those days, older players didn't help you because, as I say, you threatened their job. So they kept secrets from you, whatever they had. They didn't share so much. I'm sure there were exceptions. There were mentors, too. But nonetheless, my father couldn't find any. He learned to slide wrong. He would extend his hand, you know, to counterbalance the weight of his weight of his body going down. And that's not what you do. You let your hip hit first rather than your arm or your hand. And so he jammed his arm and could never throw well after that. Anyway, so he had this career in Buffalo. And so my childhood was more stable than somebody else who moves around, like a serviceman, somebody who's in the service, the U.S. Army or Air Force or whatever. They move around a lot more. Because he was 11 years in Buffalo, so I was there for my first 6 years and then moved to a place called Jamestown, New York, where he started to manage for the first time. He's a player manager, the old Pennsylvania, Ontario, New York league called the Pony League. Lucille Ball's hometown, by the way, Jamestown, New York. And I stayed there until I left for college. Because my dad didn't want us moving around. He wanted a stable home life. So he moved when he played for other teams or coached other teams. He moved. But we didn't. Our family didn't. So we had a pretty stable childhood in terms of not moving around so much.
Well, that's
anyway, cool. Going back to the start of my career, you know. And then, you know, after getting that first job, I started working more and more and more. I thought, boy, this is easy. You know, I'll be a star soon. I get a great part in a film or something. Well, then I got three or four jobs, and then it stopped. I didn't get work for like a year. So I started studying. I'd already been studying, but I started really studying in earnest then, trying to get better and better and better. So I suggest to anybody out there who aspires to be an actor, find a very good teacher and stick with them for a year or two and learn that way and do plays, do scenes and do plays. And that's exactly what I did.
And not only
I went to school.
Not only did you do it, but you're still doing that today. You still take classes and keep trying to strive to get better.
I do. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Right now, I'm taking a look at Lear again. I did Lear in 1999 in Oklahoma City in about an 800-seat house, thrust stage. And an anecdotal story about that. They called me and asked me if I would do this, and I said, sure, I'd love to do Lear. I've always wanted to play King Lear. And I was young enough to be able to carry Cordelia. And they asked me, the producer/director asked me, do you work out? And I said, wait a minute. I don't want to have any Cordelia with it. And I made a joke about The Dresser. There's a film called The Dresser that Albert Finney is a star of. He has an incident with somebody who wants to play Cordelia, and he makes sure he feels her thighs. And the reason he's doing that, she thought he was making a pass at her. He wasn't doing that. He was seeing whether or not he could carry her. The death scene, Cordelia's dead, Lear has to carry her. And in my case, when they called me, they told me it was a thrust stage. I would have had to carry this heavy Cordelia 40 yards. And I said, if she's heavy, I'll need a wheelbarrow to carry her, because I'm not working out that much where I'm lifting heavy, heavy weights. I was working out at the time, but not a muscle guy. It wasn't Arnold Schwarzenegger. Anyway, so I did not. I got a light Cordelia, so I needed somebody. I said, I will only give me a light one. Give me a slim Cordelia, and lo and behold, they did. It worked out pretty well. I could carry that thrust. Anyway, I had a great time doing that. They wanted me to only rehearse for 2 weeks. I said, no. They were rehearsing 7 weeks. I said, I will come in, amortize the money over those 7 weeks. And I don't want any more money. Just pay me incrementally then during that period for the next 7, 8, 10, 12 weeks, I guess it was. I'm going to rehearse the 7 weeks with the company. But I've been working on it for months. And I was taking a class, helping me with a mentor to help me get through the text. And I'd done Shakespeare, but not that much. So it really helped me. And so when I got there, I was ready to go. That 7 weeks really helped me get involved and immersed in the role, so much so that I did get nice reviews. And it was a great experience. I loved doing it. And I want to do it again. I'm thinking of trying to do it again here in New York. I'm talking to people about it. And who knows? By the end of this year, I may be involved in rehearsing a King Lear for the second time.
Well, that would be wonderful, because one of the things I've never seen you in live in theater, and it would be cool to have a chance to see that.
Yeah, well, the last thing I did in New York, was a show called Final Follies. By the way, Meryl Streep came to see it, by the way. One of her roommates at Yale was Deborah Rush, and Meryl came because Deborah invited her. The Cherry Lane Theater in New York is in the Village, the West Village. It's an old, iconic theater. We were doing it there. And after the show, I had a small role, too, by the way. You know, there's an adage, no small parts, only small actors. Well, I had a nice part, but not a major role. But I had a nice role. And Meryl Streep came back. I wanted to meet her, and other guys had gone and met her. And I came a little bit late to that little party. And she looked at me and said, oh, you were so wonderful. Do you mind if I give you a hug? So Meryl Streep gave me not only a compliment, but a big, big hug. I've been, there's a nice Jewish Yiddish word called kveling. I've been kveling ever since, feeling this warm glow inside of me. That was, in 2018, I think, 18, 19. And, you know, I've had a couple of compliments like that in my life, doing theater. And these iconic people have told me these, gave me a nice compliment. You never forget that. I mean, Meryl Streep, I'm a huge fan of hers. And now she's a fan of mine. How do you like that?
Well, I think everybody's always a fan when they see somebody doing something well, you know, or you know,
yeah.
They really appreciate the work because they understand the craftsmanship that goes with it.
I mean, we've all had compliments in our work, no matter what we're doing. I would hope we have. We haven't. I'm sure you deserve some. And then, but depending on the source, of course, there are iconic people that when it comes to them, then you think, oh my God, it's great. So anyway, be that as it may, my lady's calling me, and hold off. She had to take her mother. My the love of my life is a woman named Ariana John, and we're trying to get married next year. And she's taking her mother to an audition in New Jersey, because her mother would have trouble finding out where Montclair is. So she went down, and they got on New Jersey Transit this morning, and they're at an audition right as we speak.
Oh.
And she told me how it went. She just called. They had the audition at 1. So Interesting. So I'm involved with people in the theater still. My friends are all in the theater mostly. Matter of fact, earlier this morning, a guy that shot a movie, a short film that Louise Lasser and myself did, you know, Mary Hartman. Louise Lasser played Mary Hartman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are you going to plan on doing another film? That's one of the reasons I'm going to LA on Tuesday. So I'm still involved in the game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're like I said, iCarly, you were on that, and then they're doing the revival series, and you're still playing the grandfather on it. So you're
still playing the granddad on iCarly, yep. On iCarly.
Yes.
And so, yes. So you can have a long, long career for an actor. You don't quit until you die.
Well, I think some actors retire because, for whatever reason, it could be that they don't want to keep putting the work in, or the magic's left. You never know. Everybody has different reasons why they leave the field that they're doing. But I think if you're still enjoying it and still love it, why not keep doing it?
Right. I think what happens is, you know, learning lines is harder as you get older. It just is. Olivier stopped because he realized he didn't have the stamina anymore. And that's one of the things that does happen when you get older. The stamina for theater, I'm talking about. You do 8 shows a week, you know, in theater. And do matinees, another show at night. That takes stamina. And Lear doing Lear would take a lot of stamina. And that's one of the things I'm worried about. If I want to see if I'm really pretty good shape, I have to start exercising more, which is a good thing. And so my stamina will have to build up my stamina in order to do Lear, because it's a huge role. But I'm up for that. But then memorizing all the lines is one of the things I want to take a look at in the ensuing weeks as time goes by, to take a great long look at and see how much work I have to do and how much I remember. So that's part of the reason I think people leave. They can't remember. And then as you get older, your sleeplessness, you don't sleep as well as you used to for all kinds of reasons, some just maladies. So if you're not getting enough rest, your stamina is much less. So that's another thing I have to take a look at. And I think that's what happens to some older actors as time goes by. And then things like Alan Alda right now, poor guy has Parkinson's. So that gets in the way. Although he's doing stuff, it doesn't bother him that he shakes. And God bless him, you know.
That's what I mean. Everybody can find a way around some things, but like you said, some people will come up with different reasons why they want to stop. Not come up with them, but things happen to them, which could lead.
And the other reason is I think another reason why older people have trouble. Ageism does exist in our business. Our culture is much more prone to want youth. You know, we're a young country, quote, compared to other countries in the world, and we love youth. We love young people. We love new young people, writers for television and film. They want new young writers, especially they come from Ivy League schools usually. Or they're looking for people with, you know, intense, intuitive, intelligent, creative brains that will create new motifs and new modes of entertainment and film. So in television, there's a tremendous demand for that. And our culture tends to look at young people. At Asner, you know, I know Ed pretty well. We had talks about ageism and what to do about it in the industry, because the industry is prone to look at somebody 60 years old as being ancient. Of course, that's not the case at all. And as you get older, there are fewer and fewer parts for old people. And so I think people scale up when they get older because there's just not that many roles. I remember when I was young, if I went 2 weeks without a job in television or film, or even theater, I thought something's wrong. Now I'm lucky if it's every 2 months I get an audition, every 3 months. So there's much less demand when you get older. Of course, the competition is less too, but nonetheless, it's harder. And I think people would then get, well, screw it, I'll just quit. You know? But I'm not like that. I'll find a play I want to do and then try to do that. Or right now, even a short film that I want to do.
Exactly, because the love is still there, and you want to find a way, and the drive is there, the hustle, so to speak. Like, you just want to get in there and get to the work and find a way to do it. So you're always on that push, and as long as that's there, but the drive is there, you'll find something. It might take you, like you said, a little longer to find it, but the work is there. It's just not as easy to find.
It's not as easy to find because there isn't as many. There's not as many roles as somebody in their 40s, for example. I mean, that's much more demand for that, 30s, 40s, for men, 50s maybe. And then 60s begins to dwindle. There aren't that many roles. And you get to be 80, forgot about it. There just aren't that many roles.
Yeah.
You know, you play somebody in their 70s or late 60s. So you look for stuff. So that's when you have to get creative too. You know, I'm looking for stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not buying any books, although I should be, but I'm not. Or I don't mean buying them in terms of, you know, purchasing a book, but getting the rights for a book or a story that might be right for you. I'm not doing that as much as I should. Although I just talked to an agent, not an agent, but somebody who works for a big agency.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're in the literary department, so they're looking at stories a lot. So I've got that person looking out for me. So we'll see. Anyway, so it's still, I'm in the game. That's all. And however, it's whether it's a doubleheader or a single, a fun game, or just inning, I'm up for it. Okay.
Even if it's I'll be a pinch hitter. Just put me in, coach.
Yeah. I'll be a pinch hitter, too. Yeah. I'll sit on the bench, even. Anyway.
Now, in the movies, I think one of your first roles that I could find was the shakiest gun in the West.
Oh, with Don Knotts. Yeah, it was fun. Don Knotts was great to work with. Just, we had such a blast doing that movie. It was fun. Yeah, he was great. God love him.
That's what I was wondering about, because Don Knotts, I mean, I love, you know, Andy Griffith's show and the amazing Mr. I'm trying to remember the name of the film now. Falcon, or the flip, the one he plays, the guy that turns into a fish.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it either. But you know, working with Don Knotts, I did a couple of game shows with him too. My wife and I, Meredith McRae at the time, did a couple of things with him. It was great to work with. Just great.
Yeah, because I was wondering, because you're directed by Alan Rafkin, and and it, what was it like? Because, I mean, you were doing a lot of TV, you were doing theater, and now you're finally, you know, it's like...
doing some film?
In the film. what's the difference? I know there's subtle differences between the acting, between the three.
There are. I mean, the work is the same. It's just you do less, you know, you're not as vocal as you would be on stage if you're not mic'd. And those days, theater, you weren't mic'd. Nowadays, you are mic'd on theater, in theater, so... you don't have to use your voice quite as much. But, yeah, so less is more. I mean, I studied with Lee Strasberg, and he would always preach that, less is more, less is more. In other words, you don't have to do that much when you do film. So that's one thing. Film and TV are quite similar. They're both cameras, and they catch your, you know, your face and your body, but mostly your face and shoulders, and you act in that kind of area where you don't do that. You don't have to tell us what you're feeling. You have to just feel it and just let it be. And the audience will supply the emotion or what they'll read into you, into your performance, what's going on, because they know the story. And so you don't have to do that much to communicate with an audience. You just have to be there. Anthony Hopkins talks about this. Just be there. Yeah, let me, and feel whatever you're feeling and let it be there. Let the story tell the story on your face. That's all. Just leave yourself alone and let go and tell the story and say the words. And know your lines really, 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 really well, like a prayer almost. So you don't have to think about them. Just whatever's good. Find out what's going on in the scene, why you're there, who, what, why, where, and when, and just let it flow out of yourself rather than try to make things happen or mug, try to indicate to an audience by, you know, making a gesture or a facial expression. That's not the way to act. You just let yourself alone. Listen, and respond, whatever comes out. As long as you know the story, you know why you're there, who, what, why, where, and when. If you play the why in the scene, why am I saying this? And just stop thinking about it. Just let it happen. And things, you'll be just fine. You'll be very good, actually. And let the audience do the work.
I've watched I've watched a lot of your work, obviously, recently in prepping for the interview. And one of the things I noticed is it's hard as all get out to see you act. In other words, you're so natural because of what you just said, being into that role. It is, it's tough for me to see, is he acting or is he playing himself? And I think that's probably, I think one of the best compliments you can give an actor is you don't know if they're acting or not because it seems so naturalistic.
Well, that's the point. That's the point. You know, there's a book by one of my teachers named Eric Morse, No Acting, Please. And so that's exactly, there's a foreword by Jack Nicholson in that book. I happen to be in it. There's a picture of me in it. He's a member of the Actors Studio. And Eric preaches that. No acting, please. Just be. Be. Anthony Hopkins talks about that. Mm-hmm. Just be. Brando talks about that. Just be. You can do stuff. It doesn't mean you're playing yourself. You're playing the character, but not indicating or putting stuff in there that you think should be there. It may or may not. Forget about that. Stop thinking. Just react. React to what's being said. Hear, and then let the camera do the work. If you're thinking about lunch, that's okay, as long as you're thinking about something. But you don't have to indicate to it. You don't have to telegraph it. You see what I mean?
Exactly.
And some acting classes, there's what they call a being exercise. You just stand there and don't do anything. Because you're alive. And when you're alive, things are going on in your head, whether you like it or not. In your eyes, things are going on. When you're talking to somebody and you're just listening to what they're saying, there's all kinds of things going on in your face. They're subtle. But you have to show us what you're feeling or show us. The audience gets it. Trust the audience. Just be there and listen and tell the story. That's all.
Oh, I agree.
Go ahead. What?
James Garner, to me, was one of the natural people that did such a natural job of doing it. Showing it didn't look like he was doing any acting at all. And he brought up one of his things when he was very young. I think he was in Judgment at Nuremberg on stage and playing one of the judges.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're on the stage for a lot of the film, or a lot of the theater. And some of the judges were just fading out, disappearing. And he realized the only way for him to stay from losing focus was to focus on everything that was going on around him in the theater. In other words, the actors and paying attention to what they're doing. And it helped him with that focus because it was basically for the whole run of the show when he was there, he forced himself to stay focused on what was going on in the moment at the time. And I can imagine as an audience member, when you looked at him, he was the one judge who was actually paying attention to what's going on. And you would be like, oh, he's doing a great job. Where the other judges might be fading in or out for, you know, according to what he was saying, some of them he'd have to tap to wake them up. So you never know, but he said that helped prepare him for his future.
He was absolutely right. Absolutely right. Paying attention to what's going on. Listening to what the other actors are saying, knowing the story, and that's all you have to do. Just get immersed in the action of the play or the scene in a film, and that's all you have to do. And just be there and listen and know what's being said to you. And not react. And let your intuition, let your instrument, yourself, play its own notes, rather than your brain trying to tell you what to do. And you're thinking too much about what should be there is the downfall of every good actor. The epitome being what a bad actor does. I think that should be in there. So I'll put this little movement in, or I'll put this little thing of inflection in my voice there, make it cuter, or make it funnier, or make it better, or whatever. And that's the death of it. You know, it's trying to do that because you think it should be there, rather than simply listening and letting whatever is there be there. That's called trusting yourself. And that's hard to do because every actor, even in life, people think, oh, Jesus, I shouldn't have said that. Or maybe I shouldn't have done it that way. Maybe I'm asking for a raise. Maybe I should have raised my voice a little bit more. Maybe I've done it. If you're sincere in asking for that raise and have damn good reason why you should be paid more, then your conviction will probably win the day. How one goes about it is something you can think about, but then when you're doing it, you just have to forget about it. Oh, gosh, maybe I should say it this way next time or now in my next sentence. Now, trust yourself. You'll come up with the right answers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, all right. Enough of the acting lesson, I guess.
Well, I think that's...
But, you know, it's true for life, too. I mean, people lie all the time in life. And,
Wasn't it Brando that said that everybody's an actor, you know, and he was adamant about it?
Well, they are, you know. Exactly. Right. The world's a stage. Everybody's on stage. Everybody's acting in their own best self-interest. For the most time, oftentimes to their detriment. What they think is in their self-interest is not. But that's a whole other story about values. But, yeah, when you go to work and you don't feel like going to work, aren't you acting? Like, oh, boy, I really want to go to work today because I love my job. That's what you want your boss to think. You don't feel like it at all. How do you get yourself, you know, involved in your work and make it more interesting for yourself so you do a better job? And if you don't like your work, then I suggest you find something that you do.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Or it could be you're going to a party that you really don't want to go to, but, you know, your spouse is like, no, you're going. And so now you got to, you know, you don't want to look like the guy that has that face the whole time. I don't want to be there.
Yeah, right, right. And then oftentimes I find when I go to a party, I have a good time. I don't want to go in the first place, but when I go, I do have a good time. So there's that too. So,
mm-hmm.
So you don't have to act like you're having a good time. Just have a good time. Attitude can change everything, and that's true for acting, too. If you go into a scene and know what your attitude of that character is, you can play that. That's part of the story. So you got to know the story. You can't say, oh, just be me and not care about the story. Go, no, you have to be involved in the story of the play and the film, whatever it may be, and the character and the life, et cetera. So you have to do some homework about who is this guy? Who is this person? And how do I immerse myself in the story, the life of the play, and the character of the play? You can ask yourself questions when I teach. I tell students, ask yourself those questions. Where was this character born? Where was I born? You don't always use I. Well, you can make up a story. What did my parents look like? What kind of house did I live in? So pretty soon you'll find yourself, you're being Daniel Day-Lewis. It's kind of work, you know. I wouldn't go so far as to have my children say, Mr. President, when he was playing Lincoln. I think that's what he had people do. His children even say, Mr. President, to him. I wouldn't go so far as to do that, but I don't think it would hurt. But my daughter would never call me Mr. President, ever, ever, ever. Ever. Mr. Knucklehead, maybe sometimes, but nonetheless.
Yeah, I know my children would never do that. Children are great for keeping your ego in balance.
That's for sure. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Thank God I have a good daughter.
You were in one of my favorite TV shows that I got to watch in reruns growing up, and The Big Valley.
Oh, yeah. I love doing Westerns. They were fun. They were fun. Big Valley. I forget. I don't know if it was Big Valley or the Virginia or one of those shows. I had to ride into town, rear up a horse, shoot off my gun, rear up a horse and shoot off my gun, and then gallop out of town. I have a story about that. I was not a great rider. I didn't grow up on a farm. I didn't grow up, you know, in a stable. I learned how to ride when I was a kid because I had an uncle in Canada who had I wasn't born in Canada, but I had some relatives up there who had a stable of horses. And I got thrown in a horse once. I was scared of horses.
Mm-hmm.
So I got this job doing this Western, right? Big Valley. It was Big Valley. And I remember Strasser though, I said, say you can do anything and then learn how to do it. So I had ridden horses before. It wasn't that so much. It was the fact that I rear up a horse, shoot off my gun, and gallop out of town. that's a part I was a little bit frightened of. I'd never done anything like that. Never reared a horse up and stood in the stirrups like that as it reared up. I never did that before. So I had to learn how to do that, and I had to learn to do it in a weekend. So I went to a stable in L.A., and luckily I got this wrangler who didn't put me on a horse. I said, I got to learn how to do this. And he said, well, okay, the first thing I want you to do is start grooming that horse. He knew I was afraid of horses. So I groomed a horse for a day, and that's all I did my very first day. This was a Saturday. I thought, oh, my God. I haven't even gotten on a horse, and I have one more day to learn how to ride a horse, rear up the horse, and shoot off a gun and gallop out of town. That's what I had to do Monday morning. So I had Sunday now, after grooming the horse all day and shoveling its horse shit, as they say.
Yeah.
And getting rid of that, putting into a bin. And that's all I did for 8 hours. So I haven't learned a damn thing. So the next day, I go, and he gets me on a horse. I wasn't afraid of the horse anymore. He has me, you know, put the belt around the horse to get everything intact. So when I get up on the horse, I'm safe in the saddle. So make sure my saddle is intact. Put the bit on and the whole thing. And horse and I got to know each other a little bit. And we started walking. I got on the horse. We start walking. We walk for about a mile. So I'm just on the horse. The next thing we do, we begin to canter just a little bit. Trot. First and then canter a little bit. So I'm cantering now. And pretty soon, after a couple hours of that, trotting, walking, trotting, cantering, and now I'm able to gallop. I could gallop then. We galloped. And then he taught me how to rear up the horse. And I did that. Finally did that. By the end of the day, I knew I could go in there Monday morning and do what I needed to do. My confidence grew exponentially with each little tear up. I was sore as hell, though, I must say that. On Monday morning, my butt was sore. My legs were sore from gripping. But I got on the damn horse. They gave me a studio horse who knew exactly what to do. I almost didn't do anything that I had learned so much. The horse knew what to do. And I did the thing, shot up the gun, one take, I'm out of there. They are so happy with me. Here's a guy who looks like a real horse. He knows what he's doing. I pulled it off. My point being, all the young actors out there, when you say, I can't do that, tell them that you can and go out and learn how to do it on a weekend or a couple of days. Learn how to do it. And by God, 10 to 1, you'll be able to do it. No problem. So say yes and then learn how to do it.
It sounds like the wrangler, the guy that was training you, was doing a Karate Kid type moment where he was like your wax on, wax off, groom the horse, take care of the
horse.
That's
right.
I mean, it works.
And it works. I wasn't afraid of horses after that. I never had any trouble riding after that, and I'd done a lot of Westerns ever since then. You know, I did a Gunsmoke. In the Gunsmoke, I didn't have to gallop, though. I had to ride in a little bit. This is the first Western I did, Gunsmoke.
You were like in the Guns of Will Sonnet. You were on, Bonanza?
Yeah.
You were on everything. Daniel Boone. Yep. I mean, you're on tons and tons of Western-type shows.
I know. And the most fun I had was doing a show called Centennial, where I had to play a gunslinger named Mule Canby. So, in the story, Centennial, James Mitchell's big novel, Centennial, is about the West. And this character, Mule Canby, his right arm got cut off in an Indian war. An Indian tomahawked him and destroyed his right arm. So he didn't have a right arm. So I had to learn how to quick draw. I'm right-handed. But I had to learn to quick draw with my left hand. Well, that wasn't easy. So there's a guy, Monty, I can't remember his last name. Monty somebody or other. I can't remember his name. But he was a wrangler. And he was a North American quick draw artist, champion. The story about him, somebody had burglarized his home and who had a gun. And before the gunman could pull the trigger, Monty had reached for a gun on his on the table next to his couch and shot the guy and then called the police. And the police told him to drag the guy outside. The police had told him, no, keep the guy inside. Don't drag him outside.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't want to take him outside. You want to keep him in.
Yeah, outside, no. Keep him inside. Don't drag him outside. Keep him inside. Don't get him out of your house till we come. And so, and then he had broken a window in order to get into the house. Anyway, make a long story short, he was a great teacher. I paid him like $1,000, I think, at that time. It was a lot of money to teach me how to do it. And by God, I was able to do that too. So I, another advice, more of the same kind of advice, learn how to do it. Pay somebody, learn how to do it, and tell them you can do it before you can do it, before they test you, and then learn how to do it, and then you'll be able to do it. And I was. So I could quick draw with my left hand just as well after that as I had done it with my right hand. If I had to pin my arm behind my back, that was hard to do. Ride a horse that way was not easy. Got both hands, but I was able to do that. So I was pretty good by then.
But then you had a number of years of doing it, so it's not like it was a one weekend go.
I would ride quite a bit after that, because I knew I was going to do more Western, so I make sure I was pretty good in the saddle. It was fun too. I liked riding horses. I still like it. I'm not Ronald Reagan, but I still like it. I don't have a horse or a stable like he did.
Mm-hmm. Now in Centennial, since you brought us up to it, you worked.
Yeah.
You had talent galore every episode in that. I mean, that whole miniseries was just loaded with great actors and actresses. I mean, you had.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard Chamberlain, Raymond Burr, Robert Conrad, Richard Crenna. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just, it goes on and on and on. Brian Keefe, Sally Kellerman, Lynn Rengrave.
Yep.
What was it like working with, do you have any stories with any of those, any of the people you worked with?
Well, yeah, I do. I'm trying to think. I can't think of the actor who played James Bond, an English actor. Looks a little bit like Olivier. Damn it, I can't. He played James Bond.
Timothy Dalton.
Timothy Dalton, that's right. Stories about Timothy Dalton. And Timothy got into a little altercation with a guy over a girl when we were on location, Del Rio, Texas. We were shooting Centennial there, the cattle drive north. Timothy apparently had made a pass at this girl. Unbeknownst to him, it was one of the other cowboys, quote, in the company that he had made a pass at. I mean, had made a pass at his girl. And he took exception to his other actor. And they got into a fight. And Timothy Dalton got a comeuppance from this guy who was a pretty good fighter, I guess. But Timothy's not a little guy. And he was bigger than the other guy. But the other guy gave him a couple of whacks, and Timothy went down. And he had a shiner for a little bit, had to put makeup on his eye. So it wouldn't be seen on camera. So there's always that. There's always that. Even a company of actors, There's always people coming around that are, quote, available young women, available who would get fascinated by, I don't know, you call them groupies, I guess, if we were rock stars, who get fascinated with filmmaking and want to meet actors. Apparently, Timothy thought this girl was available, and she wasn't. It was somebody's girlfriend. He had made it quite, I guess, I don't know. I wasn't there. I didn't see it, but I heard about it. I saw the fight, though. And Timothy didn't do so well. Even though he thought he was a pretty good fighter, he was not. He caught up with the wrong guy. He was real, almost a real cowboy. With Ben Oranger at one time. And this guy had done stunts, too. So Timothy came up with the wrong guy. He picked the wrong girl, that's all.
Yeah.
And there's always stuff like that, some kind of conflict sometimes in filmmaking, where people don't get along as well as they might. It's just an anecdotal story. It's not a great story, but it's one that happens on sets and in life. People get into conflicts over women. It's the way it works.
And some people escalate them, or instead of de-escalating, and some people just want to have a fight. You never know. I mean, it's like this. De-escalate, and some people are like, "Nope, we're going to end this with a fight." And I'm like, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah, but oftentimes it's over a woman. But I got knocked down by a paratrooper over a woman once, and so, and I went after him too. But I did finally catch up with the guy. Got into a nice fight with him. The last fight I ever had, I was 24 years old. The last fight I ever had. Over a woman. I've been dating this girl who's a jazz singer in Chicago. I was doing a play in South Bend, and she was from South Bend. We'd gone. I met her at Mr. Kelly's in Chicago. I was doing a play in South Bend. And so on the way back to South Bend, we stopped at a place in Michigan that was before we hit the Indiana border, because there was a place there that she knew the band that was playing and wanted to come in and go in and say hello. So it was at a roadhouse. So we went in there, and she did a set. She was a scat singer, a jazz singer, a scat singer. And she had, in those days, this was in the 60s when she was wearing a nice mini dress, a very attractive young lady that I was dating. After the set, we decided to leave and say goodbye to the band, et cetera, et cetera, and went outside, had a car. I let her, I opened the door for her. She got in the car. I turned around, somebody hit me. And I went down. It was like one of those white light, suddenly stars. And I went down. I found myself by a tree. I wasn't kind of knocked out, but stunned. And I got angry at the guy. They took off. These two guys took off. And I got in my car. And I ran them off the road. Got out of my car, got in a fight with his paratrooper, and I just come out of the army. And And so I was in pretty good shape. And I beat the guy up. He was bigger than me, but I knocked his tooth out. I felt so sorry for him that I helped pay for his tooth, which is really crazy. I gave him some money. I said, I was terrible. I'm sorry I knocked your tooth out, but you shouldn't have hit me. The other guy refused to fight me. He didn't want to fight anymore. So it was the last fight I ever had. And I'll never have another fight. Although at times I'd like to, but I'm too old and too infirm to fight anybody now. But I never had another fight after that. So anytime I had an altercation on a set, and there were a few, I never got into a fisticuffs with anybody. I just yelled at them or told them, you know, back off or whatever. So there are conflicts on set, but they're usually resolved pretty safely.
Yeah, well, it's like a lot of people don't realize that actors, it's different. It's a different job than what most people do, but it's still a job. And it's just like in every job, there's going to be good days, bad days, and there's going to be those days where two people are having a bad day at the same time, and boom.
But for the most part, that never happens. I mean, rarely does that ever happen when resorts to fisticuffs.
Well, I was meaning boom, like in words or whatever. It's just, you know, some things happen.
No,
but, just like at any, anywhere.
Yeah.
No, one of the things
when go ahead.
I said one of the things when you and I were talking at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, that you wanted me to bring up during the interview was a movie that's the 50th anniversary of it. Poor Albert and Little Annie. Or it's also known as I Dismember Mama.
Yes, indeed. That and they changed the title, and guess what? It became a cult film, and I guess still is because it's still in circulation. But yeah, I don't remember that film that well. But during the Mid-Atlantic, as you say, Jerry Rushy reminded me she played my daughter. I mean, not my daughter, but the girl, the 12-year-old girl that was Little Annie. Reminded me of the movie, and I hadn't seen her in 50 years. She's now in her mid-60s, I guess. She was 12 at the time. And it was great seeing her. Hadn't seen her in 50 years, and we had a nice little reunion to exchange numbers. I'm sure we'll see each other again. There's always that in film. And Margaret, I'd done a movie with her, with Joe Namath, called CC and Company.
Yep.
Played a motorcycle guy. We were in a motorcycle gang. And Joe Namath is one of our leaders. Then a number of years later, a movie that Lee Grant was directing, was the movie of the week. Anne and Margaret and I hadn't seen each other in like 22 or 23 years or something like that. And said, we do a movie every 20 years together. And she's great, by the way. I love Anne Margaret. She was great to work with, a beautiful woman. And just the nicest human being on the planet. Most actors are really, really nice. There are exceptions, of course. People get bad reputations because they're cranky or ornery or divas. But for the most part, most actors are generous and kind and willing to work and, you know, do their... When you do a close-up, most actors want to be there by the camera to help you talk to somebody. There are actors that don't do that.
Yeah.
Who aren't accommodated that way, especially some stars. Don't want to be there. Let somebody read the text. Let the script girl read the text. And so you have to pretend somebody else is there. You're doing a close-up of yourself and looking at somebody, say, camera right or camera left, and there's nobody there. That's not fun to do. Much better have another actor there. Somebody to talk to, you relate better. But some stars don't want to do it. They want to go home early. I won't name names, but there are a few. But those are few and far between. Most actors are there for the other actor. Because they've been there.
Yes.
You know? Well, most stars were not made, you know, overnight. Most of them, like Jack Nicholson, took years to become a star. I remember having dinner with Dennis Hopper, Jack Nicholson, Harry Dean Stanton, another actor named Bruce Mars, who quit, became a monk. And having dinner, and Dennis was talking about, oh, man, I'm going to do this movie, man. You know, Rip Torn is going to drop out, man. Maybe you'll do it, Jack. And that was Easy Rider. Made him into a star. And then Five Easy Pieces. Jack hadn't had a job in 2 years. He's a great guy, by the way, Jack Nicholson. I don't know him well, but we were in a class together with Eric Morris. That book I talked to you about, No Acting Please, Jack, wrote the foreword to that book.
That's amazing, you know, because it's some of the people you've been able to associate with on the way up or doing the different work is kind of cool, because a lot of people don't get to hear these stories and learn more about the people behind, you know, as long as you see them is on screen. It's nice when you get that behind the scenes type stuff.
Yeah, Dennis Hopper was a trip. I remember this. I forget who he was married to when I first met him. I went to his house. It was up in the Hollywood Hills somewhere. And he had a big clown, like a papier-mâché clown. I mean, big clown, maybe 8 feet, hanging from the ceiling, a big, tall ceiling, hanging from the ceiling. And then outside in the backyard was a Chevrolet, 1955 Chevrolet Impala billboard, huge billboard in the back. And then in the bathroom, I had a little thing too. Well, never mind. Also, there was some nudity some paint. You know, he was a photographer. He loved to throw photographs. He had a camera. He was a camera bug. And he had a lot of nudes around. So young ladies. So Dennis had a penchant for stuff like that. Interesting guy. Really interesting guy. I didn't get to know him well, but I did get to know him a little bit. I never worked with Dennis, but I heard stories about him. And then, I went to his house that one time, some house. It was really interesting. Very different. He was married at the time. I forget who he was married to. I think it was Howard Keel's daughter or somebody like that. I can't remember. Some famous singer's daughter. I can't remember who it was, though. So that story's not going anywhere after that, after this. Because I don't have anything more to say about Dennis Hopper than that.
Now, when you brought up CC and Company, what was it like?
Yep.
What was it like working with Joe Namath, who was a football player, trying to act? How good of an actor was he? Did he try to really do well at it, or was he?
He did pretty well, I must say. You know, he had a talent, and the nicest guy in the world. I mean, you know, Mike Battle was also one of the players in the Jets who played for the Jets. He was a defensive back. He would eat. He could also eat a light bulb. Really tough guy. Little, not a big guy. Very tough guy. Mike Battle was his name. And he played for the Jets. the year they won. And but Joan Amos was had some talent, no question about it. And he did stuff afterwards as an actor. He did theater and musicals after that. So it's not as if he wasn't without some talent. He definitely had it. Of course, he loved publicity, too. And he loved the ladies, that's for sure. But he was great to work with, and he did well. The movie is still around, CC and Company. Take a look at it. Anne Margaret was the female lead. She was great to work with, and so was Joan Amos. It was great. Had fun, more fun on that show. We got called one night. We shot all night long, and in the morning, we went to this donut shop in Tucson, Arizona, and we all had our costumes still on. We were a motorcycle gang, you know, like the Hell's Angels.
Uh-huh.
And we scared the hell out of the woman, and Mike Battle pretended we were real motorcycle gang, and scared the hell out of the people, a couple of women in this donut shop we stopped at on our way back to where we were staying. And they called the police. And the police came, and we finally explained what we were doing, and like they let us go. But we were touch and go there for a while. They wanted to arrest us. And the women were accusing us of intimidation and stealing. I think Badley got a donut behind the counter. He'd gone behind the counter and got some donuts, which we paid for later. But anyway, it was very interesting where reality and non-reality makeup are costumes began to merge, and the police came. So we can't pretend we're a motorcycle gang in life and get away with it without getting into some trouble. We weren't a motorcycle gang. We were just actors with a bunch of costumes on. Scared the hell out of a couple of women in a donut shop. He made it as if it was real, and it wasn't, and he made a mistake. And so we had to talk our way out of being arrested.
That movie also had the late, great William Smith in it, too, if I remember right.
Yes, it did. Yeah, William Smith. Yeah, Bill Smith was really, he was fun to work with. He was, and a good guy, really good guy. Yeah. He worked out. He's a muscle guy, too, boy. He might have messed with Bill Smith or William Smith. Man, a nice guy. Great to work with him. I think I did a few other things with William Smith on Westerns after that.
Yeah, because he's in, like, everything. I mean,
he was for
like, a 40-year period or a 50-year period, it was there's tons of TV movies. He was always doing something, either in a supporting role or more of a lead role, but he was always great.
He was. He's a nice guy, really nice guy. Most actors are very nice. And most people in our business are really, really nice and get along with people and make sure that they make sure that that happens, that they're thought of that way and thought of the way to be nice and generous. So there aren't that many divas. And the ones that are talked about, of course.
Now, a lot of your shows that I've seen, you play either a good guy or like a neutral.
Well, I play some bad guys, too.
But you play some bad guys, and one of them I'm thinking of right off the bat is My Friends Need Killing.
Yep.
You know, and that was
an interesting, yeah.
I was like, that's an interesting
it was a
film.
Movie. It was. I helped produce it too. I liked it because it was about the My Lai massacre. Now those people listening who are too young to know about the Vietnam War, there was a massacre in My Lai where forget the guy's the captain's name. He was a captain. Who had a squad, or a lieutenant, maybe it was a lieutenant, had a squad that massacred some Vietnam villagers during the Vietnam War. Just lined them up and shot them because they were Vietnamese. And because the reason was revenge, because some Viet Cong, who were villagers, were also Viet Cong at night, had killed some, you know, a buddy of his. And part of his squad. And this was a new squad, some new men. And he persuaded them to kill these villagers. And it was called the My Lai Massacre. So this movie was about that, about a guy who had been in the massacre and was guilty of killing villagers, who had flashbacks about it, and the guilt made him want to kill the people that actually did in his squad that had done the killing. He was on a revenge seeker. He was deranged, PTSD, but in those days they didn't call it that. Battle fatigue, call it what you like. But he had decided that he had to go kill some of his friends, some of his buddies that had done the killing. And that's what the movie is about. It's more about that massacre. But this, they changed the name of the film from, I forget what it's called, the movie about the My Lai massacre. They changed it to My Friends Mean Killing. And that became a cult hit too.
Yeah, I think it was supposed to be called Echo of a Massacre.
Echo of a Massacre, that's right. Yes, yes, you're right. Sorry. Echo of a Massacre was the name. Yes. In the very beginning, there's a flashback scene where in black and white, you view images of the killing. And I'm asleep, having a dream, and I wake up and my wife, my real wife at the time is Meredith McRae, playing my wife in the film. That had its own, that was a real bedroom scene. Not a very carnal kind, but about a flashback. And that's the opening, one of the opening scenes of the film. So the audience knows that that's the motivation.
Yep.
And then they changed the name to My Friends Need Killing and became like a vengeful film. It became a cult film and did very good business. Because Echo of the Massacre didn't have the name value like I Dismember Mamba. Changing the name of the film that makes it even to a bigger audience, has more audience appeal to a certain audience, I guess makes a big difference for distributors. So they do that. And we gave them license to do it because we were interested in making a profit on the film, which it finally did do once the name was changed. So there are marketing reasons for doing that, which is a whole other area of filmmaking that has to do with bean counters rather than the story. But yeah, even Shakespeare changed things so he could make more money. Mm-hmm. You have to have an audience in order to get enough capital to be able to do another one. So there's always the business side of the business.
And now, in this movie, just like with I Dismember Mama and Marigold Man, it was all the same director, Paul Leader.
Yeah, Paul Leader. Yeah, his daughter, Mimi Leader, has done films. Her very first film was a film with two big stars, George Clooney and Nicole Kidman. She had been a script girl on Hill Street Blues.
Okay.
Which I did one of those. And he gave her an opportunity, the producer, to direct one of the Hill Street Blues, finally, after many years of being a script girl. And lo and behold, her career started. And her first movie was that film that they shot, I think, in Prague, with George Clooney and Nicole Kidman. Pretty good start, huh?
Oh, I don't think you could say there's anything wrong with having those two in your movie.
No, not at all. But Paul Leader did a lot of interesting B movies that I happened to be a part of because we had been friends. I had done a play that he wrote, and that's how we became friends. And that's when I first met Mimi Leader. She was 17 at the time when I first met her. But I was my late 20s. And that time I did a movie called Marigold. And we shot it, part of it, at a theater, the Fountain Theater, where we'd done the play. And there was an apartment above that the guy who ran the theater lived there. And we used that apartment on a balcony for some of the scenes in the movie. Yeah, I did about 10 of his, about 10 of his movies over the years. We were good friends. When he say, I'm going to do a movie, there's a party, and I say, okay, fine. Don't even have to send me the script, I'll do it. Because we were friends.
And that's the key thing, is when people see that you do good work, great work, and you get along with it, and you get along so well together, it's like, oh, if I get Greg, I know I'm going to have this part here taken care of, I'm set, don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, of course, people Yeah, getting to know the right people is, in any endeavor, is it's not what you know, it's who you know. And that helps a lot, you know. Sure, you're going to work with people you know will do a good job. That's true for any business. And certainly in the film business, the same. It's just you get lucky, you know. You got to get lucky because you find a director, work with somebody in the very beginning of your career that goes on to become a big director. You're gonna work for the rest of your life, probably. Unfortunately, most of us don't get to know those guys that become big directors. Dennis Hopper, I'm trying to think of people that I've known who become stars or big directors. When I was young, I don't know anybody. I don't think there ever became a big director of film that I knew personally before their careers began to become star careers. I never was fortunate enough to know anybody like that, except maybe Paul, who gave me work. But he certainly wasn't a Class A director. He did B films and good ones, interesting ones. One that he never got done was a movie that he wanted to do. He was in the Army when he was 17 years old in World War II.
Okay.
And he helped liberate, I think it was Buchenwald. And that's where he met his wife. He was a kid and met his wife. His wife was in Buchenwald. And he later married her. He wanted to do that story about liberating somebody. And it was a great script, too, but he never got around to it. His kids, Mimi, at one time had talked about doing it, but, you know, she's fallen out of favor a little bit. I don't know what she's been directing lately. You know, careers come and go. Mm-hmm. Just the way it is. You know, as I said before, Easy Rider, Jack Nicholson hadn't worked in 2 years. So you got to get a break. To become a movie star is like winning the lottery. I mean, Jack's the only person I know who became a big star that I knew as a young actor. I knew people that did well, but not as a young man having contemporaries who became big movie stars. Jack's the only one that I can remember.
And I think,
you know,
I think like yourself, the most successful thing I think an actor can do is make a living off just being an actor.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, you've already beat a lot of odds.
Yeah. Yeah. I've made a good living at times and I'm very, very blessed to have had the career I've had and have still. And so I'm very lucky in many, many ways. You do good work. You may not attain the stardom that you would like, but nonetheless, to make a living, that in and by itself is a big accomplishment in a business where so many people, you know, want to, aspire to, but it's so hard because there's so many people and only so many jobs. And only few get the brass ring. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can have, like I've had, a lot of little brass rings, a lot of them. And that's kind of fun, too. And the thing I like about it, I'm more anonymous. Then the movie started. When I was doing Mary Hartman, people wanted my autograph. I remember where the hell I went. And there was that 15 minutes of fame for a couple, 3 years. And that kind of panache lasts for about maybe 10 years or more, unless you get another one. But you ride the coattails of that for as long as you can. And usually it's for the rest of your life. In my case, that's the case. So I've had that. And that's very gratifying and satisfying. You know, would I've liked more? Sure. But I'm very content with the way my life is going and the way my career is going. Anybody who wants to try, give it a try. If it's your passion and you have to do it, then do it. If you don't have to do it, if the fire's not in the belly, don't do it. Because it takes that in order to get over the big, big, tough bumps, and there are lots of them. There will be times when you don't work. And you'll say, what am I doing this for? And if you can't ride that wave of passion to the next job and wait and be patient and keep getting better, then you probably should be able to, you know, get that plumbing job. Or don't give up your gas station job. That's what I tell people. Keep your day job.
Yeah, keep your job until you finally are making it, you know, sustainable on your own.
Well, yeah, and don't change. Yeah, for example, there's so many people who are on a hit show, but they want to do movies, so they leave the hit show. And oftentimes, so many careers have tanked after that because they expected to do a movie that would be a hit or something, and it's not. And then that wonderful role they had, say, on MASH. There are people who left MASH. There are people who left Cheers.
Yeah.
Hit shows don't come along that often. And you can ride the coattails of that for the rest of your life. You know, I'm witness to that. I'm an example of that. So don't change boats prematurely because you, unless you get a terrific role in a film that you know is going to be a hit, don't jump off the boat too soon because you might wish you hadn't.
And
that's all I can say.
And speaking of, you brought up Mary Hartman. Mary Hartman, you know,
yeah.
Norman Lear made that thing, you know, pushed that through to get it out there in syndication because at first it wasn't.
Yeah, he did. We were a CBS show to start. We were on for two nights a week, and that didn't last very long because our ratings were terrific. People didn't know what to make of the show. They had no laugh track, so-called sitcom, which we kind of were, but not really. We were a parody of soap operas. It was designed to go on five nights a week, five times a week. It's a soap opera format, mm-hmm. and that was what we were doing. And so Norman, I don't know, CBS and Norman reached some kind of agreement. We got off the air anyway for CBS. And Norman syndicated the show. He had people go out and talk to independent television stations throughout the country. We began to work at Metro Media, at KTTV in Hollywood, which Metro Media was called. It was a loose association of independent stations throughout the country. And I'm not sure if Metro Media was already there or whether it formed because of us. I think it's a two-way street that way. And we got into a whole bunch of markets, over 100 markets that way, like big markets too, like New York and Los Angeles and big cities throughout the country, Chicago, St. Louis, Miami, Houston, Dallas. Throughout the country, we got into big markets through the independent stations in those markets. And we became a hit with the format that we had, a late night, early afternoon, or late afternoon, wherever the market was. Like in Seattle, it was in late afternoon, I think around 4. For the University of Washington, students used to watch us then. Some professors wanted their students to watch this show, and they did there at the University of Washington. So we were a cult hit among the so-called literate, literati, and especially young people liked it a lot. So in that sense, Norman, a great entrepreneur, great go-getter, and had visions that he had that he knew certain shows would do well. And he would hire people by the seat of their pants, he would say, and his pants. In other words, if he intuitively thought that person was right, they were right, and usually he was almost always right about that. Go with your gut. And he did that. That's how I got cast.
And that cast is just the talent that was in the show is amazing.
Yeah, great. Yeah, we had great. Louise is great. Dabney Coleman was terrific. Mary Kay Place, Deborah Lee Scott, Philip Bruns playing the father, and Dodie Goodman the mother, Graham Jarvis playing Charlie, and Mary Kay Place, of course, playing Loretta. The country singer. We had a great cast. All did well afterwards. And unfortunately, a number of people in that cast are gone. Phil Bruns is gone. Dodie Goodman is gone. Deborah Lee Scott died way too young. Grandpa Larkin. Norman Lear has been one of... Norman and he had known each other before, and he chose him. He was a character actor. Movies, black and white films mostly. And he chose him to be Grandpa Larkin in that movie. In our show I'm talking about. And anyway, who else?
There's one person I want to ask you about. That
yeah.
Sid Haig, because he played Texas.
Sid Haig? What about him?
What was he like to work with?
Sid Haig and I, Sid Haig, it was great to work, but I love Sid Haig. Sid Haig and I had been the two guys, two motorcycle guys in CCN Company. That's when I first met him. He and I had our way with Ann Margaret in the back of a limousine in that movie, CCN Company, as it were. And it was fun. We're trying to have our way, as it were.
Yeah.
And Joe Namath, of course, rescued her. Yeah, Sid Haig, great guy to work with. I love Sid Haig. And I haven't seen him in years, though. I don't know if he's still with us or not.
He passed but away, sadly, a couple of years ago, I think.
He did, didn't he? Yeah. But we didn't stay in touch as much as we should have, but we did for a while. But, he was great to work with, really great to work with. Fun, great fun, and funny, very funny guy. We had a lot of fun during that movie. And afterwards, we did some things together, too. So he's gone. He's gone to that big ranch in the sky.
Yep. Eventually, we all head there.
We all head for that. Yep. All heading for the final corral.
Now,
yep.
As I say, like it was interesting because I grew up. Mary Hartman was on, you know, and it was on in our area too late for me to watch it on any regular basis. You know, I could catch it like an episode here or there, and. And out here, my eldest brother would talk about it because he was 8 years older than me. So he was able to stay up late enough when it came on in syndication in our area. And so I always knew about it, but I was just, it's like one of those shows where I would be, it's like, he loves this show. So you try to like sneak it in here, sneak it in there. And he'd help me, you know, get around mom and dad on occasion.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Funny you should mention that. Alec Baldwin said the same thing. Alec Baldwin was a fan of our show. He was 16 at the time. His parents didn't want him to watch because they'd stay up late because it was around 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night here in New York. And so he had a little black and white TV, one of those little handheld ones, you know, the small one.
Yep.
Like a cell phone, about the size of a cell phone now. And he would watch it on that. And he just covered it sometimes. His parents wouldn't hear it or be able to know they had a TV on. So he's a big fan. I think that's a great little story about it. Alec Baldwin's taste for offbeat comedy. God knows he's a master at it. And he was a big fan. He's a fan of mine, too. Thank God I'm a fan of his. So I found that out because I did a play. He and Marlo Thomas are good friends. I did a play a few years with Marlo called Clever Little Lies off Broadway. And Alec, we did it in East Hampton, in the Hamptons. And he has a house out there. And he threw us a big party. We did it out there in the Hamptons, and afterwards, opening night, he threw us a big, big party out there. Alec Baldwin did. And I got to know him then. I got to talk to him. I'd seen him before. I'd met with him before. I'd done a reading of a play with him years before that. So he reminded me of that, and I reminded him of that. He told me the story about watching Mary Hartman, how much of a big fan he was when he was a kid, when he was 16 years old. So that was fun. He's a good guy.
Now, there was one thing that I saw you do, and you're on many episodes of Insight, but I watched one earlier before this interview, and the one I chose is Anyone Listening, where you're with Martin Sheen.
And yes.
I was just blown away by the scenes of the two of you together when you guys are making the breakthrough for his character, and how it was riveting. It was riveting.
Well, working with Martin Sheen was a joy. He's a terrific guy. Very nice, generous actor. He's not a friend of mine, although we've worked together a couple of times. But he was generous, really generous, great spirit, and got along very well with him. So we did some good work together because we liked each other a lot. That helps. You know, your personal relationship with the other actor is very paramount to doing better work. The more you get along and the more you like to rehearse, I like to rehearse. We got going. We got some juices going in the scene that way. And we knew that we had we were ready to have, I call it fun, the joy of acting, doing things well, something well, is always a joyful moment for me. And it was for him. So we loved the work. and that love for the work showed on in the scenes we did. So it's always great to have great compatibility with whomever you're working with.
Well, the chemistry the two of you had was awesome.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the episodes because it deals with mental health and and seeking the help when you need it, you know, and not thinking that it's a sign of weakness, which is what his character is looking at it, which is ironic because he was so used to helping other people because he played the priest and he's so used to giving counseling to other people. But here when he needs it and the father that sent him to that, and he kept talking to, kept saying, no, you got to make this. It will help you get through. And and it was just great. Like, I just really enjoyed it. And I think it was an episode that a lot of people really should seek out and see. It's on YouTube, and it's easy to find and easy for anybody to watch.
Well, I didn't know that it was on YouTube, but I'll watch it again myself. Okay. So everybody hang up. I'm just kidding. But, well, I look at it. My God, you know how long we've been talking?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, just because you're a great storyteller, and I'm just captivated with the things that you've been saying.
Well, I got about 100 more, too. Sometimes my memory isn't as good as it could be.
Well, we always got to leave something for listeners wanting more, you know, and your credit list is tremendously long. But I do want to ask you about working with Michael Landon, because you worked with him in Bonanza and Highway to Heaven.
Yeah, Highway to Heaven. Michael was a great director. He could shoot fast, efficiently, and get what he wanted. Boom. The crew loved him because you get out by 5 o'clock. And that's not true for most sets. Television is, you know, time consuming. And there's always that conflict between time, excellence, and money. The producers wanted to get done fast because it saves them money. And the director wants to get it done well and efficiently, but good. And the actors want it to be good. And so what he was able to do, he could shoot in a way that would save time in cuts. He knew what he wanted, so he was able to cut, shoot a scene as if it were already in the camera and ready to be cut, didn't need to be cut, because he could shoot exactly what he thought would be needed for the next moment in the film. He did it in a way that was simple, yet effective. Instead of doing a great big group shot, for example, the establishing shot, they call it, he would then cut to what he knew would be the next shot. He would shoot maybe an establishing shot that he wouldn't have to really shoot. He would either have the camera move into a two shot, so you wouldn't have to worry about cutting to the two. He'd do that with the first shot, establish, and cut to a two. Not cut, but move to a two, have the camera move. So he would do stuff like that, would save time. So is that. The only thing that we had differences of opinion politically, he was very interested in me. Maybe he told me that if I wanted to, I could learn to direct. And so I watched him direct and I said, oh boy. He could teach me. But the unfortunate part was, politically, he was at the opposite end of the post. He was a very right-wing guy, believe it or not, Michael Landon, a gentle, kind of nice man. Also was very authoritarian in his viewpoint about what to do with immigrants at the border. He wanted to just either build a wall or shoot whomever moved trying to get across the border. Because I was not like that, of that political persuasion. So I never did take him up on his offer to direct. But I respected him a lot. I liked him a lot. He's a really nice man. I was so sad to see it that he passed it way, way too early in age. But I never did take him up on the directing offer, which I regret in a way. At the time, I was a little more hot-headed than I am now. So best that I, at that time, did what I did was say, gee, I'm busy doing other stuff, but thank you for the offer. So the very fact that he offered that to me, I thought was very, very generous. So he's a good guy, and I'm sorry to see him have to leave the planet at such an early age. Sad.
It's there's so many people that leave before their time, and you always yep. wonder what they would have been able to do if they would have lived longer, or if their careers would have went longer. There's so many what ifs, but the beauty of it is you can enjoy the work that, at least that they did while they were here.
Yep. And I also, some people like Brando, for example, you know, like a great hero of mine as an actor, I mean, all the choices he made, I mean, you know, his work is astonishing. He's an innovator, an iconic innovator of his time. I mean, he made people start acting like him because he was so gifted. But he didn't use his gifts as much as he was full of self-loathing because of his upbringing, I guess, in Nebraska. Some mother issue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of psychological baggage he had. He could have done so much more and left us so much. I mean, the work that he did leave was great. The work that he could have done might have been even so much greater. But he just frittered away time and opportunities that he had because so much self-loathing, which some people have, and it's a sad thing. That I feel regret for him in that sense, that he was a genius actor that could have left us with a lot more legacy than he did. But thank God for the legacy he did leave and the stuff that he did leave. So I'm thankful for that. But he could have done so much more, as others too could have done too, without, you know, the flaws, character flaws they have had. And some died way too soon.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Landon was one of them.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And the only other thing I wanted to ask you is, just because my daughter and my sons both grew up watching the show, what was it like working on iCarly? Because I brought it up earlier, but what was it like?
Oh, really?
Because they love that show. And I watch it with them because when the original run. I haven't watched the revival run, but they were at the right age at the right time for the original run. And it's a show you could sit as a family and enjoy.
The new version is on Paramount Plus. It's not a version. It's a continuation of the same characters, mostly, that are 10 years old. That's all. They're now in their 20s, mid-20s. But working with Miranda Cosgrove and all the great characters on that show, and the terrific actors. I mean, just a joy. It's fun. Great fun. And that's what acting should be. Great fun. And it is. Even the sad roles they do, even King Lear, it's fun, great fun. And there's joy in working with, I did one not that long ago that's now on Paramount Plus. And it was just great fun going back and playing with these people and having the same good fun I had when I was 10, 15 years ago. So the joy is still there. And as I say, working with these kids was not only great fun, but a joy. And they're talented and wide-eyed and wanting to do more, and God love them all. And those of you young actors out there who think that this is what they want to do with their lives, if you have it in the belly, fire in the belly, and you're really passionate about it, go ahead and do it. You won't regret it. And if it doesn't work out, keep trying. Keep trying. Get up off the floor. You'll get knocked down. Get up off the floor. You'll have a lot of rejection. Come back for more. Go after it. God bless you all.
And I'm not regretting asking you, Greg, can I interview you for my show? And before I even really got a chance to tell you much about the show, you were like, yes, let's do it. And it was,
sure.
And I'm so happy that to get to talk to you, not only at the convention, because we talked for quite a while, the 3 days there, but, and if listeners, if you ever get a chance to see Greg at a convention, go and talk to him. The life he's lived, it's well worth asking questions. And he, as you can hear, he's a great storyteller.
Well, that's the Irish in me. You know? It's not all Blarney. Okay. Anyway, great talking to you, Steve. Let's do it again, maybe one of these days down the road, okay? And I'm sure I'll see you soon at one convention or another, okay?
Oh, thank you again, and I hope to have you on again. It was a great, great joy.
Anytime. Okay. Have a great weekend, everybody. Or week, or a life, or month. God bless you all. Take care.
I hope everybody enjoyed that interview. Just to remind everybody, if you want to leave us feedback, please send it to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. Hope everybody enjoyed the episode. And to take us out of this episode, we're going to listen to the theme of Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. And I hope everybody has a good day. Again, thanks for listening. Bye.